What is going on, everybody? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. I'm your host, Curry Blanford, and today I'm talking to Brian. So I've been excited to get this interview done for like a year and a half now. I met Brian pretty early on. One of my buddies kind of introduced the two of us, knowing that we had similar passions. Shout out to Kyle. Thanks a ton, man. But I found out that Brian was in the process of writing this book called Redeeming Work. And so I decided, hey, let's just push this off until, you know, the book gets closer. And now we're here. We finally arrived. The book's here. I got to read it. It's awesome. And we get to talk all about it here. Brian has devoted his life as a vocational psychologist to finding the ways people can best sort out their calling and work in the places where, you know, God has gifted them, God has called them. And it's really fascinating work. So we talk about the book, we talk about all the things that he's doing, the psychology of vocation and why it's so important. We talk about Jobsology, which is the company he runs and helps out with the sort of scientific aspect of finding your vocation. And so we just get into a lot of what this podcast is trying to do, which is talk about work and how we do it as Christians. And Brian has done a lot of thinking on the topic, and you're going to love hearing from him in this episode. I can't wait for you to hear it. Just a reminder to make sure you're following me on Instagram and Facebook at Theology of Hustle. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Curry Blanford to stay up to date with the amazing episodes I have coming up for you. That way, you know, all the news and all the good stuff coming out. So, yeah, make sure you're following me on all those places. And I hope you enjoy hearing from Brian. All right, Brian. Well, thanks for coming on the podcast, man. It's finally nice to meet you like in person after like, I don't know, a year and a half or whatever of going back and forth and whatnot. So,
well, yeah, almost in person. We're on video anyway. Almost, yeah.
Close. Very, yeah. Very close. Yeah. Someday we might meet in person. It'll be
that's
crazy.
Right. So. That's right. Yeah.
Well, thanks for coming on. Excited to chat. Do you mind just kind of introducing yourself to everybody to get started here?
Sure. My name is Brian Dick. You want like a professional introduction?
Let's have it all. Let's, okay. Yeah.
I mean, so typically I describe myself as a vocational psychologist, and that plays out in a couple of different ways. My main gig is, a professor of psychology at Colorado State University. And, currently I'm director of training for our PhD program in counseling psychology. But then I also am a co-founder and chief science officer of a software company called Jobsology that has developed an online career assessment system called Pathway U. Also, I'm married and have four boys.
I love it. That is that is a full household, man. Four boys. I'm sure there's that's lots of fun. So
we have lots of fun. Yep.
That's great. I love it. All right. So let's dive into your story before we kind of get into the nitty gritty here. I feel like, and you allude to it in the book and you talk about it a little bit, but there has to be like some good reason for sort of becoming a vocational psychologist. Did I say it right?
Uh-huh.
Okay. Yep. There has to be some good, like, so what is the why behind sort of that trajectory?
Well, the story is laden with irony. So at least I often describe it that way. As it turns out, I think a lot of people end up pursuing work that responds to a need they have.
Right.
So for me, if you go back to my days as a college student with an undeclared major, interested in lots of different things, but really feeling kind of fearful of choosing one, if that means not choosing something else that's also appealing, I had this decision-making style of wanting to keep options open as long as possible. So anyway, I really struggled as a Christian college student with this question of discerning God's calling. What does God want me to do for my career? And I remember just regularly praying that God would reveal his will for my career path in a very clear and unmistakable way. So I would be praying for this divine revelation. And I don't think I expected an audible voice or a Moses in the desert burning bush type sign, but I did believe that I would, in some kind of supernatural way, get clarity. Like I would wake up one day and just know, or the veil would be lifted and everything would be clear. And, you know, that just never really happened, at least in the way that I thought it would. It ended up being a much more gradual process. So anyway, that's part of the story. I ended up going into graduate school after declaring a major in psychology. I liked psychology. I liked other things too, but I had more credits in psychology than those other things. So it was the path of least resistance. And then grad school, it was like, I still don't really know what to do, but I'm a good student. I don't mind school and you know, I want to help people. Maybe I'll become a therapist. And I looked at different areas of psychology of the various areas that are available for folks to pursue a graduate degree in. Counseling psych seemed the broadest to me. Hmm. You could teach, you could do research, you'd go into private practice, consult for organizations, college counseling centers, all that stuff. So I thought that by pursuing that path, part of the appeal was it would effectively delay the decision of, you know, what I really was going to do with my life when I grew up.
Yeah.
I don't know how much detail you want here, but I'll keep going.
It's great. I love it. The story's the best part, you know?
Okay. All right.
It's great.
So, I, you know, applied broadly to different grad programs in counseling psych, and I did so fairly naively. So for our undergraduates now, sometimes I give a workshop called How Not to Get into Graduate School. Using the path that I took, where you look at what faculty are doing at different places, and then you write an essay talking about how those things are your passion and all of that stuff, and you just let the chips fall. And that kind of happened to me, and providentially, I got into a program at University of Minnesota in their Department of Psychology. It's one of the top five departments of psychology in the world, and they were well aware of it. I mean, there was a very strong culture there. But one of the things I discovered when I got there that I should have known before getting there was that this program I was in had a long history of making contributions to research and theory and applied tools related to career development. And so kind of from the get-go, I was immersed in learning about vocational psychology and psychology of career choice and development. And I wasn't quite sure it was really for me, but I started to sense that there were aspects of this that really fit well. For one thing, I was still grappling with this whole decision of what I'm going to do professionally. And another part of it was we had it in that program a vocational assessment clinic, where as graduate students, the trainees, we were providing career assessment and counseling services to adults in the community. Many of whom, you know, middle career adults, objectively very successful, subjectively totally miserable. So we had these folks who had good jobs with good salaries and benefits, but they were just tied to them with golden handcuffs.
Yeah.
You know, having a lot of obligations, it was too risky to give it up, but they could hardly get out of bed in the morning. They hated their jobs so much. And some of them, without any prompting from me, would say something like, I wish I had discovered my calling. And that was super interesting to me, in part because I was still grappling with this whole issue myself personally, even as I was kind of facilitating a process where these people would benefit and would, you know, find a sense of direction. And so I got to a point where I thought, man, I should really pay attention to what psychologists have had to say about this topic. And so I did a lit review on this quest to find every empirical study that studied a sense of calling using the methods of science in the social sciences. And at that time, I found a total of eight studies in all of history that used science to study calling. And, you know, a lot of them didn't use very impressive methods. And some of them used what I considered to be kind of a watered down way of defining a calling. So you follow your bliss, you know, a passion is your calling. Mm-hmm. And that's certainly part of it. I believe that's part of it, but that's not all of it. I mean, there's a much richer way of understanding calling that I had been reading about in all of these, you know, practical theology books that I was reading at the time. So that's really the point. where I thought, you know, maybe one of the ways I can use the gifts I have and leverage the training I've received is by studying in a serious way this notion of calling and its function and role in people. And so I did that. I discerned that maybe part of my calling is investigating calling. And I launched a kind of a program of research. I was fortunate to get a job offer in the Department of Psychology at Colorado State, where I've been since 2005. And we've developed a network of collaborators. And, you know, there's still a kind of a drop in the bucket. But whereas there was initially 8 studies in all of history, now there's more than 600. Right. And that's awesome. And it covers, you know, it's a global phenomenon. I mean, every continent except Antarctica is now has now got scholars doing work on this topic. So, you know, that's kind of a long meandering answer to your question, but that's the story of how I got interested in the kinds of things I'm doing now.
No, I love it. And I love how much your story, I mean, I've talked to a lot of people now about their career path and whatnot. And it's amazing just how many people, I mean, certainly like knowing what they want to do and knowing their skills are very beneficial, but also there's just some like, yeah, well, it just seemed like a good thing to do. And so I just started doing it to it as well. You know, it's just incredible to me, you know?
Yeah. Well, there's definitely a passion element to it, but it's also, if we want to experience meaning in our work, then you find yourself latching on to things that really speak to a need.
Yeah.
And in this case, it was a need that I had personally, but also a need that I saw others having as well. And so, yeah, I mean, one thing led to another, right?
Yeah. How much of how much of what you've seen, like from there being 8 research studies done to when you started to like 600 now, how much of this is like a cultural sort of way of thinking about even career in general?
Yeah. Well, the timing was right. I mean, I think part of it was a good time to start looking at this. You know, it was interesting when I think back on my decision-making process, part of it at the time was, you know, who's going to do this if I don't do it? And I laugh at that now because so many people are involved in this area of work. And I was very fortunate to kind of get in at the beginning. And so I've developed relationships with a lot of these folks. But yeah, there was kind of a cultural awareness of this way of thinking about work. And certainly, you know, for Christians, it's a core focus of how we view our vocation, right, as a calling from God to express our gifts in ways that make the world better, that, you know, thinking redemptively about things. But it's not something that's solely for Christians either.
Right.
You know, Oprah has published issues of her magazine, Find Your True Calling, you know, across the cover. The Dalai Lama has a chapter devoted to calling in his book, The Art of Happiness at Work. You walk through the career section of any major bookstore, you'll see books with topics that have, or with titles that have calling in it. So, you know, it definitely seems like people want more out of life. They want more out of their work.
Yeah.
You know, we can appeal to Viktor Frankl, who described the search for meaning as a basic human instinct. And I think that's true. And so, of course, it would show up within various life domains, including and probably especially work as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, especially in our culture just gets so much, there's just so much more to do now, right? It's like, it's just amazing how fast cultural is shifting just even beneath our feet right now. I feel like, you know, the movement of it and what technologies are coming in, and it's just, it's amazing.
It's definitely a moving target. Yeah no doubt about it. Yeah.
That's good. That's good stuff. Okay. So I'd love to hear about your work at Jobsology. I think it's such a cool thing that y'all have going on. I would love to hear more about all of that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, that started about 10 years ago, really, where a colleague of mine, who's an industrial organizational psychologist named Kurt Krieger, and I collaborated on a grant proposal. And the grant was funded by the U.S. Department of Education. And what we were interested in was creating an online career assessment system that would gather psychological information about job seekers. And then, you know, we'd combine that information into algorithms that would map it onto opportunities in the world of work. And so kind of the basic concept is an eHarmony for job seekers and employers, right? We wanted to make some of these matches because it's two sides of one coin. Ideally, by taking these assessments and getting information, people understand themselves better. And by being able to identify people with a set of psychological characteristics that really meet the needs of an open position and a particular organizational culture, the organization is able to more successfully pursue their goals. So we started building something. It was very crude, and we tested it in the community colleges in Colorado. We had four partner campuses, and so we built this system, and we look at it now and we kind of chuckle because it looks like it looks like basically we programmed it ourselves, and that's not that far from the truth. We did have a little bit of help, but these were graduate students, not professional code slingers, right? So anyway, we found that it worked, that people benefited from it. And when we paired the software with some kind of counselor facilitation, they especially benefited from it. And so the university approached us and said, hey, we think what you have might be commercially viable. What do you think about exploring that possibility? And you know, we knew that if it was only up to a couple of professors, it would just stay kind of a cool website and languish. Right. So in order for it to have legs and to really have to scale and have benefit, we needed some resources and a business plan. So we met with a couple of entrepreneurs and formed a company in 2012. We called it Jobsology. And, you know, life as a startup is a whole nother set of stories and experiences that really has been super valuable for me as an academic to experience, because it's very definitely two different worlds. But you know, basically, long story short, we now have this this software product called PathwayU that's an online career assessment system, and you know, we've got 70 colleges and universities that deploy it with their students, and a number of employers who use it as well. And there's a public site. And for readers of Redeeming Work, they can access a version of it as kind of a special bonus of buying the book. So, we're excited about it. Honestly, it's a core way through which I feel like we can harness some of the magic of the science of vocational psych and then apply it in a really fruitful way, I think.
Yeah. I definitely enjoyed it. I got to take that little assessment, and it was it's pretty fascinating. It was simple but not simplistic, right? Like it was but it was very user friendly. It was very usable, and I think like yielded some pretty cool stuff.
Well, we've worked very hard to ensure that it's as short as it can possibly be while still providing reliable and valid scores, right? Which is no small feat. If you have tons of items, it's easy to have a highly reliable instrument, but then people don't finish it, or they don't want to take it. It's too much of a commitment. So we've really worked hard to make it as short as it can be without being too short where you compromise the quality of the data.
Sure. I'm taken back to eighth grade, and my parents drove me down to Dallas, Texas to take a like 2-day AIMS assessment. It was like a career assessment back in the day. And I sat in this office with this lady for like 2 days and like testing on all these like different things. And it's amazing to me because I like still have that piece of paper with me somewhere, you know, and like, it's amazing how powerful assessments like that can be. And like your assessment, right? Just the knowledge that can come out of something like that is pretty incredible.
Yeah. What you're describing, of course, is fantastic. If your family has the resources, you know, to provide that.
Yeah, it's expensive stuff, right? Yeah.
But we wanted to kind of democratize aspects of that. And I will say there is power in assessments. You know, God created us with different gifts, and we've learned from in psychology that those can be reliably and validly measured. But I will say that, you know, not all assessments are created equal. And it's really, really important to ensure that you are using an assessment that has evidence of reliability and validity, that, you know, it's kind of scientifically vetted to provide good information, because there's a lot that are out there that people use that are, you know, just not valid predictors of the outcomes they're trying to get to. So that's a constant source of frustration for, I think, psychologists who have spent a lot of time developing these kinds of measures using science.
Well, yeah, especially as the internet gets bigger and, you know, broader. I mean, you could find almost anything out there. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's why I urge people, do not just put in career test in Google and then play with the first one that comes up.
Right.
Unless Jobsologies is the first one that comes up because, you're, you know, it's just you don't know what you're getting. Right.
Right. You totally don't. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's totally true. It is. I don't know. I'm endlessly fascinated by how difficult it is to know oneself. Right. Yeah. Like it doesn't seem like it would be that difficult because you're with yourself all the time. Like, an assessment like yours can like has so much information that like you can't possibly know by yourself somehow. It's just it's amazing to me.
Well, sometimes you just have to, I mean, knowing the self is a tricky thing. There's obviously people that are so complex. And I think part of knowing the self is taking a step out of your own head and then looking at yourself through a different lens. Or applying a particular kind of framework that, you know, has been shown to be useful in understanding differences between people and then seeing kind of how that model applies to you. And that I think that's where assessments are helpful. You know, they're not magic. It's not a crystal ball that tells you what you should do with your life. You know, no assessment, but I think that's really important to stress. Like our assessment has a career match tool that uses algorithms to make predictions about career paths that are likely to fit you well, but it doesn't tell you what you should do. Right.
Right.
And so a lot of people, there's this temptation to look at whatever that top match is and say, oh, I took that test. It told me I should be a shepherd or something. And, you know, no assessment can possibly tell a person what they should do. It's just a source of information.
Right.
And if it's rooted in science, then it's a really, you know, like beneficial source of information to use, but it's not a panacea or the only source.
Right.
So that's important to keep in mind, I think.
Yeah. So how does Jobsology go about like these evidence-based sort of matches for, you know, certain personalities, and how does all that work?
Well, so the Pathway U assessment measures four things. Interests, so what you enjoy, values, or what you find important in a work environment, personality, which is kind of general tendencies or how other people experience you, and then workplace culture preferences, which is basically your values for particular aspects of organizations.
Right.
And so then it takes that information and it combines it, and then it maps it onto baseline data for what happily employed people across 1,000 different occupations experience. So, and it does that by leveraging the U.S. Department of Labor's database for occupations called the ONET. But if you've ever gone straight to the ONET, it's short for the Occupational Information Network, then you know it's just overwhelming. I mean, just the amount of volume of data is just hard to digest. So we've tried to kind of curate that and distill it down into a more easily digestible form with the information that people care about most kind of presented first. And people can dig in and get all the details if they want. But it's meant to just provide a more streamlined way of seeing how their interests and values, you know, what the implications of those are for what types of career paths are most likely to prove both engaging, interesting, but also satisfying and meaningful for folks.
Mm. Yeah, that's cool. I love that. That is, it's amazing. And you, so like, in order to do this, you interviewed a lot of people, right? And even in the book, you interviewed quite a few people for this and young people and all of that stuff. What would you say is, I mean, is there an aspect that people don't know about themselves most? Like, what's the biggest hurdle, do you think, to finding calling for most people?
It's tough to answer that in a blanket way because it's so idiosyncratic. People have different hurdles. I do think, you know, there were aspects of my own journey that are relevant here. Like sometimes people ask me, what advice would you give the 19-year-old you back when you were praying for divine revelation?
Right.
And part of that was, there's just a lot of assumptions that people make about, you know, what it means to have a calling. So, you know, this gets into some of the things I cover in the book, like these half-truths that people tell themselves, like, you know, like a calling is something to the ministry. And so do I have a calling? And if I do, it's probably something to the ministry. Or if I care a lot about my faith, then I should be a minister or a missionary and consider those things first. And, you know, I mean, my grandparents are missionaries and my dad's a pastor. These are very important roles within the kingdom, but, you know, they're not roles that God calls everybody to. And one of the ways that God calls people is through their gifts, right?
Right.
And so rather than praying for divine revelation, what I probably should have been praying for back then was divine wisdom and awareness of what made me unique. So, yeah, I mean, a barrier, some people don't really have a clear sense of what their gifts are, or they find it difficult to put language to those.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that Pathway U is designed to accomplish, is give people a language for describing how they're unique, at least in terms of their interests and values, which we know are linked to, you know, job satisfaction and all these different outcomes. So, yeah. I mean, so that's one barrier.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, another thing that you see that I talk a little bit about in the book is that time-tested saying, like, God doesn't call the equipped, he equips the called.
Right.
It's that idea that, you know, even if you're not really well equipped to do something, God will give you what you need to do it well. And while that is true, I mean, God certainly does equip the called, it's just not true that he doesn't call the equipped. And this, to me, just speaks to the importance of attending to your gifts. And as a driver and making a decision and kind of discerning what your calling is. So, you know, all of the kind of biblical stories that Christians point to when they dish out that phrase, you know, like Moses was concerned about his ability as a public speaker. And so they say, well, God doesn't call the equipped, he equips the called. And that's true. I mean, he did give Moses some help with public speaking and provided his brother Aaron to step in when needed. But, you know, there's a reason that God called Moses. I mean, Moses grew up in Pharaoh's palace, right? Like, like who would be better suited to, you know, have those conversations with Pharaoh than somebody who really intimately understood the inner workings of that whole world. So, yeah, there's a lot of goofy things that Christians kind of believe that are not totally wrong, but not totally right either.
Yeah.
That can end up serving as barriers to really freely living out a calling in an unconstrained way.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, there were several times I wanted to just like shout amen. I think I may have a couple of times in reading the book, because you do, like, I mean, this whole podcast is sort of built around this idea that like being a pastor and a missionary is not a higher calling than any other calling out there. It like, you're called to do different things, right? And it's just because maybe you're called to be a pastor for a period of time doesn't mean that that's your forever vocation that you always have to be doing, you know? So I think all those, like, there's so many, and I appreciated that about the book, breaking down those sort of half-truths, because there is some truth into some of that, but it's not always true. And if we sort of try to live our lives in this, you know, one direction, it can end up sort of messing us up, you know?
It could if you're not careful. Absolutely. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of people that end up in pastoral or being missionaries that, you know, maybe that wasn't the best fit for them, but they thought that they had to in order to be a good Christian, you know?
Right. And that's the concern, is that people will end up in roles for which that just don't align with kind of how God made them.
Right.
Because they feel they ought to, or because other people told them they should. And, you know, I mean, God can work through people in those circumstances as well. I'm not saying that that's not the case, but that is, making decisions on the basis of those kinds of things, I think, doesn't fully utilize what we know about the way people are designed,
right.
The way God's equipped us. So, Yeah.
I totally agree. That's good. Let's talk about the book. I mean, we've already introduced it, and it's I really enjoyed the book. I think it has so much good stuff in there. You know, like we're on the same wavelength in a lot of these ways. But What was the sort of why behind writing the book in the first place?
So this book is called Redeeming Work, and the subtitle is A Guide to Discovering God's Calling for Your Career. And there were two things that really motivated me to take on this project. One was my own personal story, which I already shared about. It's that, you know, what would have been helpful for me to understand or to think through, you know, when I was praying for a divine revelation back, you know, as a 19-year-old or whatever. So I wanted to kind of write something that would answer that question. But the other thing is, you know, there is this faith and work movement that's been building within the Christian community. It's broader than just the Christian community, but it's kind of most vigorous, this conversation within the Christian community. And yeah, it's this faith and work movement. And there are so many resources that have emerged from that. Right. And many of those I found really helpful. But they're nearly all written by pastors, theologians, or business leaders, and you know, great wisdom, but most of those folks don't read or really don't even have access to social science research. Right. And There's this whole discipline that has very rigorously investigated questions about meaningful work and work as a calling and career interventions. You know, like what works in attempts to help people make wise decisions about their careers. And so it just kind of, as the more I followed that faith and work movement, the more frustrated I became that there was just this treasure trove of information that just was overlooked. It was not part of it. And so I thought, you know, maybe one thing that I can contribute to this is the voice of science. So the book Redeeming Work, it's, you know, theologically grounded, but it's also, it was very important to me to infuse some science into the conversation. So a lot of what I kind of weave in is what do we know actually helps people and actually works as they forge a career path and adapt to all of these crazy changes in the world of work that are present now and that are only increasing going forward, that kind of thing.
I totally agree. And I really, enjoyed that quite a bit because there is that interplay, because you talk about, you know, even spiritual disciplines maybe for as you're sort of walking out your career calling and some of that, but at the same time, like these, you know, scientific ways in which we understand work and how you can best figure out what your career calling is. It's pretty great. Because I know there was a lot of writing that went on and you sort of had to pare it down a little bit, you know, to get the book. So what was one of your, as you're writing the book, what was your, one of your greatest sort of like learnings as you were doing that?
Well, I think it was, you mean as far as the process of writing goes, it's interesting. Before, you know, I, in 2012, I wrote another book, Make Your Job a Calling, with my friend and collaborator, Ryan Duffy. So it was a co-authored book and it was for a general market. And I thought, even then, I thought, boy, someday I would love to do a book specifically for Christians.
Yeah.
And I thought that because it was something that was like speaking to kind of, you know, my tribe, and that was something that I so obsessively have thought about over many years, that it would be really easy to write as a result.
Right.
And what I was surprised at is that actually, I was so obsessed with kind of getting things right.
Right.
That it was far less efficient. You know, it was just kind of like there were many voices in my head, kind of imagining different groups of people reading this that I was trying to take into account and address, that it ended up being a much slower, more plodding process than I expected it would. I thought it would just kind of flow. And there were elements of it that certainly did, but there were also times where, you know, it just kind of felt like I was hitting a brick wall trying to say something the way I wanted to say it, and it just wasn't coming out that way. So, you know, a 1-year project turned into a 2-year project. But you know, that's just how it goes. The more I talk to other authors, the more I realize that this is extremely common.
Yeah. So. It's just twice as good now, right? Because you spent, you know, twice the time on it. So it's perfect.
Well, and you're right. Your memory is good. There was a round of edits where I cut 17,000 words. So that there was some pain and agony, but to the credit of Templeton Press and the outstanding editorial staff there, it is much better than it would have been had all of those words been retained.
Yeah, so, sure.
Yeah,
sure. I mean, there's a pastor joke that says, like, if you want a hour long sermon, give me a day. If you want a 30-minute sermon, you know, give me like, you know, a week.
Sure.
If you want a 10-minute sermon, give me a month. Yeah.
Makes sense. I get it.
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting. I'm having flashbacks too. I recently went to preach. I try not to preach too much on work, faith and work, just because it's something I do so often on the podcast. And I went to like preach a sermon finally on it. And I'm like, I'm going to nail this sermon. And like, I literally spent a week just spinning my wheels. Like it was so difficult. Like this passage doesn't say, you know, it was
sometimes
very complicated.
When you're so close to something,
yeah,
it can be harder to figure out how to distill it down in a way that you want it to be received by others. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. And to your credit, I think you did that. And this was a very readable version of this book, you know, and I appreciated that there was real life examples of people that sort of how their career trajectory went about and why they did what they did. And thought that was super helpful.
Thank you. That was really important. I mean, how do you learn? We learn from observing other people. And if we identify with people who have gone before us and who are doing something that we want to accomplish, you know, in this case, kind of thinking redemptively about their work and in meaningful and satisfying ways, then it gives us confidence that we can do that too. So that was really important for me to include those stories.
For sure. Yeah. They were super helpful. And that season of life, like that college age sort of around that whole zone, right? That quarter life or whatever, experience is just so complicated because you're supposed to like sort of have worked out exactly what you're going to do for the rest of your life when you're like 20, you know, or even younger, you know. It's it's very difficult on these kids, I think, sometimes.
Well, so I mean, the kinds of issues that we address in the book are relevant across the full, you know, the full lifespan. But we did, I mean, I did focus on young adults because that's where these kinds of issues become front and center for the first time. Where there's a lot of pressure to make these, you know, there's structures in place, culturally imposed structures that require you to make a decision. As simple and direct as if you're a college student, you can't register for classes if you haven't declared a major when you're a junior, right?
Yeah.
At most places. So we tried to speak directly to the sets of issues and concerns that are relevant for young adults. But another thing that you kind of are hinting at, the world of work is obviously changing. It's much different than it was even 20 years ago, and change is the name of the game. So one of the things that I focus on is the need to learn to adapt. Mm-hmm. There's this concept, career adaptability, and one of the most important ways to be successful, and I think to live out your faith through your work, is to be able to roll with the changes that you'll confront and embrace that as a kind of a inevitable and also kind of exciting set of realities. There was a time maybe when our grandparents just leaned on their employer to dictate what their career path looked like. We can't do that now. We're in the driver's seat of our own career. We are by necessity, but there is something that is important that comes with that. You know, we have autonomy and freedom to make choices to the extent that external constraints allow. That means we really have to take seriously some of these big questions about what it means to be a person of faith and to think redemptively about living out your faith within the world of work. It means a lot more than witnessing to coworkers and going on short-term mission trips whenever you can. It means really taking seriously that question, how can I think Christianly about whatever field of work that I'm in, right?
Right.
So,
yeah. Well, and that's a great example in the book. You shared a story about going to your first career conference, right? Where you like sat down with a bunch of young people sort of your age. Do you mind sort of like delving into that experience a little bit?
Yeah. This was actually not a professional conference. This was a conference for Christians called Fusing Faith. It was Fusion, Faith and Life. And the whole thing was billed as this opportunity to explore what fusing faith and life looks like. And so there was a breakout session for professionals on fusing faith and life at work. And, you know, it was crowded with people, and the moderator stood up as the session was beginning. And he just asked people to kind of share, what does it look like to fuse faith and life at your, in your profession, on your, in your workplace? And he asked that question, and like nobody was responding. It was crickets, you know? And then somebody, a woman, cleared her throat and raised her hand and said, you know, one way that I do this is negotiate some extra time off with my boss to go on short-term mission trips. And he's been very supportive. And, you know, people were nodding. I'm like, okay, well, that's interesting. And then somebody else after a bit said, well, I try to live out my faith by sharing, you know, witnessing to my coworkers whenever I can. You never know when you have an opportunity to share the gospel. And like, that's also very true. Right. But then there wasn't a whole lot else. Somebody raised a point about being ethical. But, you know, I kind of was raised in this Reformed tradition with Abraham Kuyper perched over my shoulder saying, Jesus is Lord of every square inch of the whole creation. There's no separation of sacred and secular. And, you know, that way of thinking introduces a whole new set of questions about what it means to live out faith at work. Because the reality is, you know, leaving your job to go on short-term missions, that means like exiting your life to live out your faith somewhere else. That's the opposite of fusing faith and life, right?
Right, it is.
And of course, we're called to bear witness wherever we are. No doubt about it. But that doesn't really have a whole lot to do with the work itself, you know, like what it means to, you know, kind of work as a mechanic on complex systems within vehicles, or to create art that tells the truth about the world, or to run a business in a way that kind of honors, you know, God's design for justice and mercy and all of that stuff. Like, that's the stuff that really I was interested in then. And I just left thinking, what just happened in there? Like, why are we not talking about the really gritty particulars of thinking redemptively, recognizing that, Christ is Lord, not just over human relationships with God and the four spiritual laws and all of that. I affirm that that's true, but he's also Lord over every single aspect of creation that defines where we spend ourselves, whether it's retail sales or, you know, plumbing or, you know, whatever, or podcasting. I mean, whatever you can think of. So what is working redemptively look like within those fields? So some of the examples that I weave into the book are of people who really have embraced that and take that seriously. And especially kind of at the end of the book, when we talk about the new heavens and the new earth and kind of building toward the new creation. I like to tell some stories of folks who are doing that in a way that I think is really inspiring.
Yeah. And I'm glad you went there, because we were going there whether you liked it or not. So because that is part of that Reformed, you know, that good Dutch Reformed tradition that you're a part of, right? Is the because most of us kind of have this impression, right, that like sort of everything's going to burn. Everything's going to be gone, and sort of like we're going to be in heaven in sort of this ethereal plane of floating around on clouds or something. Right. And that's not biblical. So can you talk a little bit just about that new creation?
It's
important.
Well, I mean, you know, if you think about the story of the Bible, you ask a typical, I mean, I don't want to be too like critical of Christians who, you know, but a lot of people, they have kind of a sin, salvation, heaven view of what the gospel means. I'm a sinner in need of a savior. Jesus saved me. I get to go to heaven. And if you kind of press them on what heaven is, it's this kind of a disembodied place of happiness. You know, I don't think people believe that we'll be strumming harps, resting on clouds. But it doesn't feel sometimes like it's all that different than that in kind of Christian consciousness.
Right.
But if you read the end of Revelation, you see that it's heaven comes to earth, right? The new right. Jerusalem comes down, and you know, the Bible starts in a garden, it ends in this garden city. And part of what that means is we are not in our work right now polishing the brass on a ship that's sinking, right?
Right.
Which is one analogy that some Christians have used. So
right.
all right. that, you know, if that's your view, then all that matters is the saving of souls. Like save as right. many souls as you can before it all burns. You know, there are some passages in the New Testament that talk about the elements burning, but that's a refining kind refining, of burning.
Right.
It's yep. the burning off of sin. It's not the burning off of God's good creation.
Right.
Right. And so part of what that means is what we're doing right now in whatever discipline, whatever field of work that we're in, is coaxing out creation's potential, even in the face of the distortions of sin that we encounter every day, knowing that when Christ returns, everything is going to be made new.
Yeah.
And there is something I think that's just like really beautiful and powerful about us participating in that work. Like God's instruction and design for us is to, you know, kind of coax out creation's potential, and also with the fall and with redemption, to do that in a way that thwarts sin, pushes against sin, and moves things in the direction that it will ultimately become when it's right. made new. You know, that is really amazing. I think it's theologically rich. It's inspiring. From a psychological perspective, I'm thinking as a psychologist, yeah. we know that when people are able to take their worldviews and then find alignment between what they find most important in life and what they're doing day in and day out, they experience joy and meaning and purpose. Yeah. So I think, you know, it's just really powerful to me that we can do that. We can experience joy and purpose and meaning in our work now, knowing that one day everything will be kind of perfected, renewed. And so, yeah, I mean, that's to me a much more inspiring, powerful, and biblically accurate vision of yeah. working redemptively than the idea of, you know, it doesn't really matter because it's all going to be sunk in the end anyway. It's just right. not true.
Yeah. Amen. I love it. That's yeah. agreed. And it speaks so much to me to the actual hope we have, which is the resurrection, which is a new life, meaning that death literally does not conquer us. And that's the good news, right? That's the gospel.
That's so, right. Amen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's good stuff. I love that. Such good stuff, man. I appreciate the work. I appreciate the book and everything you have going on in there. What are some ways people can like kind of get in contact and, you know, yeah.
Sure.
What are the details? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so the book is called Redeeming Work, A Guide to Discovering God's Calling for Your Career. And that's available kind of at the major places you'd buy books. Or it's Templeton Press. You can go to the Templeton Press site and order it directly from the publisher. I have a site that is still being built, bryandick.com, bryandick.com, that has a little bit of info about some of the work that I do and research and things related to that. So you can track me down that way. And then I just invite anyone to go to pathwayu.com. It's pathway, the letter u.com, for information about the assessment system that we've developed. And again, you know, if you purchase the book, you can access a version of it that way, but you can also learn more at pathwayu.com.
I love it. Yeah. That's good stuff. And it really was. I do have to tell you, I really did enjoy the assessment and like, yeah, it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool. So
thank you.
I love it. I love it. Okay. So I'll make sure all those are in the show notes so people can easily find all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And Liz, are you ready to jump into our final two questions here?
Sure. Brian? Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Yeah. Great question. You know, there's two that would be competing for that. I don't know that they're necessarily strange. Depends on what you mean by strange, but you know, my very first job as a 13-year-old was detasseling corn. So for people who don't know, for hybrid seed corn, you have to ensure that the male parts of one variety of corn are fertilizing the female parts of another variety. And so you have to pull the tassels off the one brand of corn. So it's like oddly sexual in that way. but as a 13-year-old, I just remember my first day of that job. It was like the harsh reality of farm work. I remember telling my parents, I think I know where people who don't believe in Jesus go when they die. It's like this big cornfield where they detassel all day.
Just detasseling all the time.
Yeah. So that's one, I guess. I did work in retail sporting goods for a while. And the thing that made that strange was it was a soap opera. I mean, the kinds of, liaisons and trysts and competing, yes, love triangles and things. I just like could hardly keep it straight, the things that were going on in that store. So
right,
you can see why people would find it interesting to develop sitcoms based on, workplaces like
workplaces,
that.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, that's the relationships you form in workplaces are just fascinating. It's also probably the most diverse experience of your entire life, so it's very interesting.
All right.
Yeah, it's good. Okay, so my final question then is, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom more into their work?
Well, it's think redemptively. I think to live out faith in your job means more than just the fall and redemption and sharing the gospel with others, although that's really important. It means recognizing, God's created intent for whatever sphere that you're operating within and thinking, how can I kind of partner with God to make this area more than it is now? But then also recognizing all the ways it's distorted by sin. How can I bring this sphere, this discipline, this area of work, this workplace, whatever it is, closer into alignment with what it's becoming, with what, kind of God intended it to be. That's easy to say. It sounds like platitudes. The way people work that out is not always so easy. But when we seek out people who are doing that well, I think it helps us personalize it and really take those questions seriously and then come up with answers that are meaningful and achievable for us.
Yeah, I love it. That's good stuff, man. I appreciate the work. I'm excited to keep following along. So I appreciate you coming on and chatting with me. It's good stuff.
It's been fun, Curry. Thanks for having me on. I've enjoyed it.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this interview with Brian. I just, even listening back to this episode, something that stuck out to me is like viewing our work in light of the end times, in light of Jesus coming back and what that means for, how we work now. And I think those implications are hugely important. So if I can leave you with one thing to think about this week, it would be that, like, what does working right now in light of, the future glory, in light of the new creation, mean for you in your work? And how does that change things? I'd love to hear the answer to that question. So hit me up on social media. I love to talk through all of that stuff. And now is a great time. If you scroll to the bottom of your podcasting app, you can leave me a rating and review there. That's just super helpful for getting the word out about the podcast, which more people need to hear about Theology of Hustle. And I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. And until next time, get out there and hustle.